Okay, so normally one begins the talk by thanking the organizers, but I'm not going to do that. Rather, I want to thank the participants because I know some of you came from quite long distances, faraway places. So thank you for coming. Maybe I should point out especially that one of our participants is celebrating his 60th birthday this year. So maybe we should congratulate Professor Balasubramanian on that. In fact, the genesis of this conference, when we started planning, was to do something for Balu in Toronto. So I'm glad he could come. So I want to talk about logarithmic derivatives of L functions. And so it's a little bit different from most of the other talks which have been concentrating on L functions themselves. And these, I'm going to take the following context. I have a number field and one can look at the Dedekind zeta function of k, which is summation 1 over norm e to the s for real part of s bigger than 1. And if you expand it in its near the point s equals 1, it has a pole at s equals 1 with a complicated residue, which we may write as c minus 1, plus a constant term, plus higher order terms. And the c minus 1 is a non-zero number, a much loved and much studied number in number theory, which I'll just write down, although I'm not going to use its exact form. It's class number times the regulator over the number of roots of unity and square root of the discriminant. So as you can see, it has all the beautiful constants associated with k, number of roots of unity, absolute value of the discriminant, the regulator, class number, number of real embeddings, number of complex embeddings, and even a special appearance of our favorite transcendental number, pi. But this is a pretty complicated thing, but if you look at instead of zeta k, if you look at the logarithmic derivative, now as you know, logarithmic derivatives of mirror morphic functions, the residues are integers. They are given by the order of zero or pole at a specific point. So when you do the logarithmic derivative, it also has a pole at s equals 1, but the residue is now 1 because it's got a simple, because the zeta function has a simple pole. So this starts off life like 1 over s minus 1. So the residue has just become 1. And now you get a constant term which we will denote gamma k. So this is notation, if you like, or definition. So the logarithmic derivative, I put minus sign so that the coefficients are positive, has a simple pole with residue 1, and then the constant term we'll call minus gamma k. So this is something that was studied by Ihara first. And it's a very natural object to study, but doesn't seem to have received much attention before his work. And one might ask also, you know, this is an interesting object. One can also study further constants here, and they're also interesting. Although right now we're finding so many open problems related to just gamma k that we're spending time to study that. Now, gamma k is, of course, related to these coefficients. Namely, it is C0 over C minus 1. Okay, so you could formulate it here as well. It's the quotient of the first two terms. Now, Ihara calls this the Euler-Kronecker constant. That's the name he gives to it. And the reason is because there are two cases in which you know what it is exactly. First, of course, is the case of k equals q. And in this case, we have the ordinary Riemann zeta function, and gamma q is Euler's gamma, Euler's constant. In other words, it is the limit. That's the constant that appears in when you take the logarithmic derivative of the Riemann zeta function. The next case is when k is a quadratic field. Now, before we say it's an imaginary quadratic field, just a quadratic field. So in this case, the Dedekind zeta function is a product of the Riemann zeta function and the Dirichlet function corresponding to the field k. And so you see from the logarithmic derivative expression that gamma k is gamma plus L prime over L 1 chi k. Now, if D is negative, that is, if k is imaginary quadratic, we have, as we've heard in several talks in this conference, additional tools for saying more about this logarithmic derivative. Namely, we have the discriminant function, delta of z, e to the 2 pi iz, which is a modular form of weight 12 for the full modular group. And if I take any ideal B of the ring of integers of K, we can write it as a Z linear combination of some base two basis elements, beta 1 and beta 2. And these will be in some fixed embedding of K into C, they'll be can be viewed as complex numbers, and we want the one for which imaginary part of beta 2 over beta 1 is positive. So this is a base, an integral basis for this ideal. And then we can set G of B to be the following number, 2 pi to the minus 12, norm B to the 6, times the delta function at beta 2 over beta 1. So this is a point in the upper half plane, so I can evaluate this function at that point. And it turns out this, one of the parts of the theory, is that this is well defined. In other words, it doesn't depend on the choice of basis. That comes from the fact, basically, that delta, the action of a matrix of SL2Z, changes delta in a very predictable way that is compensated by this factor. So it's well defined, but in fact, it only depends on the class of B. So B, this ideal B, will define some element in the ideal class group, and this, if I multiply it by principal ideal, the value doesn't change. So it's a class invariant. So now, if I take an ideal class, okay, we can consider the partial zeta function, has been discussed in other lectures, so which might denote zeta fc. So rather than the full Dedekind zeta function, which sums over all ideals, you only take the sum over integral ideals whose class is c. And now we have the most important tool in this subject at the moment, namely the Kronecker limit formula. which is an amazing formula that relates the zeta function, or its partial zeta function, to special values of this modular form. So near s equals 1. So it tells you the following thing, that near s equals 1, this thing, which also has a simple pole with a more complicated residue, has a constant term of the following kind. So let me write it out. One over s minus 1 plus 2 gamma minus log of the discriminant, and then these strange class invariants. Plus O of S. So near S equals 1, you can describe the behavior of theta SC, the constant term, in terms of these class invariants, or the special values of this automorphic form. And so, if you now add this up over the classes, you'll get a formula for the Dedekind zeta function near s equals 1. And then when you put all of that together, you get a formula for gamma k, which is 2 gamma minus log the discriminant, and it's 1 over 6 times the class number log. So that's a second case in which you can come up with a formula for this gamma k in terms of something which doesn't involve, at least a priori, doesn't involve L functions. So because the two examples we have of this constant are in the one case Euler's constant, and in the other case a constant that we can determine from Kronecker's limit formula, Ihara called this the Euler-Kronecker constant. Okay. Now, with these two examples in hand, let's have a look at two things. Firstly, the general expression for this constant in terms of L functions. Well, k is an imaginary quadratic field, so we'd be ecstatic if you give us a formula like this for general k. I wouldn't be so worried about R1 and R2. Okay, so what's the relationship of gamma to L functions? Well, here is my field, k over q. We can take its normal closure, so we get a field k tilde over q, whose Galois group we might call G. So G is Galois k tilde over q. And this field, fixed field of k, will be some subgroup of G. And then we know, of course, that the Dedekind zeta function of k is the Art and L function corresponding to the induction of the trivial character from H to G, just by properties of the Art and L function. So this induction in general will decompose as a bunch of characters, irreducible of G, and A chi's will be some non-negative integers. And so that, again, by properties of Art and L functions, that induces a product. Theta of K of S is a product over irreducible characters, Art and L function, k to the power a of chi. And so if you take the logarithmic derivative, you see that gamma k is a linear combination, integer linear combination, of logarithmic derivatives of Art and L functions. At 1. And in particular, if k over q is Galois, then the A chi is all chi of 1. Now, since the ordinal functions satisfy a functional equation between S to 1 minus S, we could equivalently, we could write, we can write gamma k as a linear combination of L prime over L at 0 chi. And that's interesting because sometimes this is the version that comes up. So I will. Yes. So I will sometimes denote by gamma k tilde the corresponding object at zero. There's another variant. I don't think it's going to make much appearance. It will make an appearance here. Variant is that we can also consider gamma k plus or minus and gamma k tilde plus minus. And this is where you restrict the character to be odd or even. Now, odd or even in the higher dimensional non-abelian case simply means that so chi is in the minus space, is in irreducible G minus, means that chi of complex conjugation is not a scalar. So if you have a real field, for example, you're not going to get any odd character. Yeah, it's the same, this linear combination at zero.
Same
A chi, yeah. So the difference, as you say, is a predictable thing. It comes from the functional equation. Okay, so that's an expression now in terms of logarithmic derivatives of L functions. The second thing to note is, and this is largely conjectural, is the connection to periods. Relationship to periods. So here one starts off with a CM field. K is a CM field of degree 2n. CM means it's a totally complex quadratic extension of a totally real field, and it's got a central automorphism of order 2. That's basically complex conjugation. Okay, now one looks at the set JK of embeddings of K into complex numbers, and we let IK be the free abelian group generated by JK. So in other words, it's just a sum Z, one Z for each sigma in JK. That allows me to make formal integral combinations of embeddings. Yes, that's it. That's it. Okay, now let's denote by phi a CM type of K. So CM type means that is a subset of, so phi is subset of JK with the property that let this distinguished central automorphism, call it rho, the complex conjugation. It's a property that phi intersected with phi rho is empty, and phi union phi rho is the entire JK. In other words, you have a set of embeddings, and for any embedding, you have a complex conjugate embedding simply by composing it with rho. Rho is central, so it doesn't matter which one you do first. So I want to partition the set of embeddings into two groups, so that if an embedding is in phi, its conjugate, complex conjugate isn't. and together they have to exhaust all embeddings. That's called a CM type. Okay, now the reason for defining this is this CM types arise in nature in the following way. If I take an abelian variety, of CM type, that is, abelian variety with the property that, say, of dimension n, with the property that the endomorphism algebra as a Q vector, as a Q algebra, contains a commutative semisimple subalgebra of dimension over Q equal to 2n. So such an abelian variety is said to be of CM type. Okay, we say such an A is said to be of CM type. Now, a commutative semisimple algebra is, of course, just a product of fields. That's a fancy way of saying a product of fields. If it happens that this algebra, but the important thing is this relationship, that it's 2n and n. If this subalgebra is a field, instead of being a product of fields, suppose it's a field, then A is the power of a simple abelian variety. Now, it's also a fact that the fields that occur in this product have to be CM fields. Such a field is necessarily a CM type. Such a field is necessarily a CM field. In other words, one of those kinds. All of this comes from the general theory of abelian varieties as found in Shimura and Taniyama. Okay, so let's say we have this kind of field, and we have an abelian variety such that this is sitting inside the endomorphism algebra. Then, of course, K acts on the homology. K acts on this. It also acts on the cohomology by duality. It acts on the Durham cohomology, and so on. It acts on everything. But because of the dimensions, this is a 2n dimensional Q vector space, and it has an action of this 2n degree field, a field of degree 2n over Q. So it also becomes a K vector space of dimension 1. So it's a one dimensional K vector space. Okay, similarly by duality here. But now, this is also a one dimensional K vector space. But now if I complexify this, this is then a one-dimensional K tensor C vector space, K tensor C algebra. So rank 1 K tensor C algebra. But K tensor C is just a product of copies of C given by the embeddings. So that decomposes this into a direct sum, I might as well write product, of pieces, one for each complex, one for each sigma. Yeah, and so far what I'm saying is just elementary algebra, and nothing, it's not deep. But on the other hand, we have also the Hodge decomposition of this, which decomposes this into holomorphic one forms plus anti-holomorphic forms as complex vector spaces. And so since I have the complete decomposition of this into one-dimensional spaces, half of these have to go here and half of them have to go here. So that means this space picks out half of the embeddings of K into C. Those embeddings, if we denote those as C, that's exactly the kind of, it satisfies these properties. So therefore, to any abelian variety of CM type, there actually does correspond a CM type. So therefore, phi is the set of embeddings set of a subset of jk which makes up H0 omega 1. Okay, so therefore starting with an abelian variety of CM type, we have associated to it an actual CM type in this sense. And conversely, if I give you a CM type, conversely, given, just by the way, I'll make one more remark before I go here. If A is of dimension 1, okay, so you have an elliptic curve, then, and it has complex multiplication, you know that elliptic curves are defined or have a model over the field generated by the J invariant. Okay? But J invariant evaluated, and the J invariant is the J function evaluated at the tau corresponding to the lattice. If I have a complex multiplication elliptic curve, that tau is an imaginary quadratic element, and J of tau is algebraic. So any elliptic curve with complex multiplication has a model over Q bar, namely Q adjoined the value of the J function. The same is true in the higher dimensional case. Any abelian variety with complex multiplication is actually has a model over Q bar. So I can start with a purely transcendental construction. Nevertheless, it has a model over Q bar. That, of course, you can't prove in the same way because the moduli of abelian varieties is more complicated in the higher dimensional case. Nevertheless, it's true. So A has a model over Q bar. Now, conversely here, I was going to say, if I start with a CM field and take a CM type, then I can find an abelian variety over Q bar with this CM type. And this A is unique up to isogeny. So the two things are essentially equivalent, and that's the beautiful thing about the theory of abelian varieties with complex multiplication. Once you get past these definitions, you can translate everything into field theoretic terms. It basically becomes algebra or linear algebra.
The field, yep. The
yes.
Starting with the
CM
type,
it
would be a subset of
IK. Set of embeddings. So therefore, the two things are essentially equivalent. Okay, now, on the reason it's important to keep both of these in sight is on this side, I have a natural notion of period. Namely, I can take a differential form. I started at 11:30? Okay. So on the geometric side, we have periods in the usual sense. Namely, I take a differential, so I have again, you see the holomorphic one forms have are indexed by embeddings of sigma in phi, so I can take a holomorphic one form omega sigma and then integrate it against a cycle. So I get a period in the classical sense. This is some complex number. It's a non-zero complex number. But the point to observe here is that this thing, as I told you, after tensoring with Q, if I extend this to Q, it's a one-dimensional K vector space. So if I chose another cycle, it's K times a fixed cycle. So if I chose some other cycle here, it's basically an element of K acting on a cycle. But then I can bring the K into here, and then it's acting by sigma of K. So changing the cycle will only change this by an element of K. So therefore, more generally, if I think of this as sitting inside not C star, but C star mod Q bar star, it's independent of the choice of C. And of omega sigma. Omega sigma also is a basis of a one-dimensional vector space. Somebody was emphasizing the importance of one-dimensional vector spaces. If I chose another basis vector, it differs from the original one by an element of k. So I'm only going to change things by an algebraic factor. So if I go to the C star mod Q bar star, it's independent of choices. So therefore, I have a notion of this period, and we will denote this one as P of sigma phi with the k here. So sigma is an element of the CM type. I chose a differential form corresponding to that eigenspace of the k action, and then I have associated to it an element in C star or Q bar star. So that's an honest period, a geometric period in the usual sense. Now what Shimura does is he takes this language and these periods and generalizes them considerably to create something called the period symbol. Period symbol. So this is due to Shimura. And this period symbol is a map from associated to a CM field on the full IK. And it has the property that it generalizes. So now he's saying, you give me any subset, any element of IK, any other element of IK, I'm going to produce an element here. And it's got to be consistent with that one. So that extending the definition of PK sigma phi. See, this was very specific. I took a CM type and a sigma belonging to that CM type where I had a geometric interpretation. But he's saying you can create lots of monomial relations by using basically what he didn't use that language, but motivic constructions. You can generalize that to create, make sense of this symbol. It's no longer a period of a traditional geometric object anymore, but it is a kind of more general period. And these periods satisfy all sorts of beautiful properties. It turns out they represent special values of Hilbert modular forms. Yeah. So this one we've already defined for any CM type. But he's saying, he's going to tell me how to, for example, take sigma tau, two singletons. See, that's non-trivial. I mean, that comes from maybe something like that, yeah, and then do some motivic construction. So what I'm saying is these period symbols represent special values of Hilbert modular forms at CM points. And they also represent special values of Hecke L functions. Okay. And in some sense, it's sort of the big generalization of what we saw in Kronecker limit formula of the special value of delta telling us something about the L function. Okay. So I think I won't go into detail about this period symbol. Yeah, but unfortunately those are pretty hard to get your hands on. So, okay, now why did I tell you all this about the period symbol? Because of Kolmez's conjecture. This is a conjecture, Kolmez and Yoshida. They didn't do it jointly, but they did it at different times and in different languages, but it seems to me that they're making the same conjecture. So their conjecture is like this. If I take, let me restrict myself to the case of a Galois extension. Okay, so K is a CM field. Now I take a conjugacy class inside G, and we look at the following thing. Product of elements in C, PK 1 sigma. Okay? Product of some of these period symbols. That should be up to Q bar, should be pi to the, some power of pi, which I'll tell you in a minute, times the product over odd irreducible characters of Actually, if you don't mind, I'm going to write it a little bit differently. Also give myself more space. Pi to the minus mu of c over 2 times exponential, the size of the conjugate class divided by the size of g, times the sum, chi in the odd piece, odd part of the irreducible characters, chi of c, L prime over L, 0 chi. So, sorry? Yeah, fix one embedding. So, this is a fantastic and very general conjecture. There's a parenthesis error, but please close the curly brace. Which relates averages of logarithmic derivatives at zero to periods. Conjugacy class. Yeah, mu of c is given by, it takes the values, actually let me put it here. I don't like this. This bracket is bothering me. Okay, mu of c is 1 if c is the trivial class, minus 1 if c is the class of rho, and 0 otherwise. Remember I told you rho is central, so it's its own conjugacy class. Irreducible characters. Oh, minus. The odd part. Remember I told you odd means that chi of rho is not a scalar. Okay, so this is a conjecture about which we don't know a whole lot, but everything we know... yeah, that's true. So, when no, that it could be there could be an interpretation like that because it is basically a gamma factor thing. It means, I guess, you apply complex conjugation to decompose the representation space, and I guess odd would mean. No. Wait, actually, hold on. So, yeah. Chi of rho will always be a scalar, right? No. Yeah. So the meaning is evident in the Abelian case, but in the non-Abelian case, I guess at least in the two-dimensional case, so maybe. Maybe I shouldn't be saying, maybe... That's right. Okay, so if we take the determinant, then it won't matter. So the determinant shouldn't be, it is an odd character in the usual sense.
Yeah,
that'll be. So then it's basically saying something about the dimension of the space. Yeah, that's good, thanks. Yeah. Okay, so what do we know about this? It's taking a little bit longer than. Okay. So what we know is basically just in the abelian case. So if k over q is abelian, but actually first let me say, by the way, if k is an imaginary quadratic field in particular, then the conjecture says that pi times. So in the case of an imaginary quadratic field, my abelian variety is an elliptic curve. Okay, so my CM type consists of one element. And so here it's saying pi times p sub k of 1 squared is exponential of L prime over L 0 chi d. And that's something we know, but only indirectly. Okay, so this is, and of course, Yeah, you get a square because you see, I'm sorry, I think because of this quotient, you see, this factor in front, to kill that. Yeah, and by Chawla-Selberg, we can interpret this as that kind of funny period, the product of gamma function at rational values. Now, if k over q is abelian, the conjecture is known. And it basically comes down to, again, the fact that in the abelian case, you can write periods in terms of gamma functions or beta functions. So this is due to Anderson, Greg Anderson, and also in different form to Yoshida, maybe Colmes too. Okay. Now, I point out something funny about this. Gamma k, by the way, let me also write one more thing before I say that. Just point out, and maybe I should have said it here itself, another way of saying Colmes' conjecture is this, that if I take pk 1 1 to the degree of k, and then I need pi to the 1 half of the degree, that is up to q bar star gamma k tilde minus.
Is that for general
CM? General CMK. This, I mean, that's what I'm just saying, that's what the conjecture says in particular. Well, if you take 1, 1, what is the conjecture saying? And that's what actually the point I wanted to make. The connection of gamma k to periods is this is a special case of Colmes' conjecture. Okay, so gamma k is related to periods in this sense, at least conjecturally. On the other hand, Colmes' original formulation is in terms of faulting heights. So this gamma k has this sort of dual property. I mean, on the one hand, it looks like it's connected to periods. On the other hand, it seems to be connected to a regulator. That's unusual because usually those two things are separate. So that's a mystery there. So the abelian case is known. The first open case, simplest in quotation marks, open case is a dihedral k over q is degree 4, so it's k to q is degree 4, and k tilde is dihedral. There is some conjectural approach there by Tonghai Yang using Kudla's theory of modular forms, or at least generating series whose coefficients are arithmetic intersection numbers. But that's not a conclusive result. Okay, so all of this, by the way, makes sense in the function field case as well, in which case we have we can say more. So the definition of gamma k makes sense in the function field case as well. Yeah. That's right. E to the gamma k. Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Right. Okay, now Ihara has been studying, as I said, he's the one that defined this object. He's been studying a lot, but his aim is to use gamma k to study value distribution study, value distribution theory. Of L prime over L1. So Selberg, as you know, started the theory of value distribution of zeta function. How often does it take a value a? So many people are interested in the value a equals 0, but other values are also interesting. And he showed that those things have a distribution function. some results are known for Dirichlet functions. In those cases, the hard part is working in the critical strip, on the critical line. Here, we're still at the edge. We're talking about ordinal functions, and we're still looking at the edge. So the problem seems to be there's still a lot of work to be done here. But he has some results in the Dirichlet, in the abelian case, value distribution of this thing. As a result, by the way, of that work, it raises several questions. Ihara's work raises questions of the growth, or the growth of gamma k. And this is something Mariam is going to speak about in the next talk. But he showed, assuming the Riemann hypothesis, Ihara showed the following, that there exist, there are constants, positive, so that gamma k is trapped between C2 log log of the discriminant and bigger than minus C1 log of the discriminant. These bounds are, this growth issue, it becomes a pretty serious thing in proving the existence of a distribution function. So, but you see there's a pretty big gap between these two results, the upper bound and the lower bound. And what Mariam is going to talk about in the next talk is to show that we think the answer is here, that it's closer to this end. So she will prove the following, or she'll discuss the following theorem. So in the next talk, we will hear about omega theorems. Okay. And I was trying to show it's actually this big. Okay, let me skip stuff now. Chawla looked at L function value. L1. It's interesting, you may think it's a little, just a small variation, but actually it becomes a lot harder. So instead of looking at the L function, we're now looking at the logarithmic derivative of the L function. So immediately what happens is zeros enter. You have to deal with zeros, so you need some sort of very good zero density estimate to be able to handle that. But you're right. So what we will discuss is the following theorem. That in the case that K is a quadratic field, gamma K is omega log log dk. And you're right, it's related to Chawla's result, Chawla's work on L1 Heidi. Right. Okay, let's skip all this. So now, in the remaining time, which is, I think, 10 minutes, 15 minutes? 10 minutes. I'd like to talk about the question of transcendence. So, the question is gamma k transcendental? So, if you can answer this question, even for k equals q, it will be very famous. So we don't know the answer. We don't know, even for k equals q. In fact, I don't think we even know gamma is irrational. But we have the following curious result. This is joint with Ram. Namely, for a imaginary quadratic field, one of the usual kind of transcendence theorems, one of e to the gamma or e to the gamma k is transcendental. The usual kind of thing, as you're pointing out, e to the gamma k has an interpretation as a period. So that's the one that's more accessible. But you get that one of these is transcendental. And remember that gamma k, in the, at least in the imaginary quadratic case, in the quadratic case, differs from gamma by just the logarithmic derivative of one L function. Is what non-zero? Gamma k, yes, it's non-zero, it's not trivial. It's non-trivial, but it's non-zero. That's some of that kind of thing is contained in my work with Ihara and Mahora Shimura. Okay. So what was I saying here now? E to the gamma k is gamma plus the logarithmic derivative gamma k. And so if we ever had, if L prime over L 1 chi k is 0 for any imaginary quadratic field, just one, all I want is one, then e to the gamma is transcendental. Of course, as usual with these really attractive theorems, the condition will never be satisfied. we don't expect it to be satisfied. So I think the folklore conjecture is that L prime, I mean, basically this is saying that L, we know L1 chi k is not zero, as we've heard in the previous talk, I think. So the question is really whether the derivative can vanish at one. So can we ever have L prime 1 chi k equal to 0? Expectation is no. Expectation. However, we can show in any case that it is rare. So we have the following result, again with Ram. Namely, if I have a prime, Q is prime, and the number of characters. So we're not answering the question of the quadratic case, but in the cyclotomic case, if you look at the number of characters mod Q, such that L prime 1 is 0, that's small. For any epsilon. So, of course, just as here you expect no, here also you don't expect any such characters, but we don't know how to prove that. The little time that I have left, I think about 5 minutes, right? Okay. I'll just make a comment, because when you see this kind of question, one is, various thoughts may rush into your mind. Because you see, we talk about non-vanishing of L functions, and usually these are good L functions. They have Euler product and functional equation, things like that. You take a good L function and differentiate it, you destroy everything. Euler product's gone, functional equation's gone, and so whatever you were relying on as sort of your key tools are gone. So you can ask, how are you ever going to prove anything about the non-vanishing, especially with no Euler product? And I just want to close by pointing out something which I think maybe is known to people who work with Dirichlet series, but surprising to those who don't, namely, that if you give me given any Dirichlet series, and let's say it makes sense to look at this, so let's say it has polynomial growth, there is a sigma naught, so that let's call this f of x. Is sigma naught so that f of s is not zero for real part of s greater than sigma naught. there's always a half plane of non-vanishing. That has nothing to do with the Euler product or multiplicativity or anything like that. It just comes from the fact that in the limit, Dirichlet series behave like their first term. If you keep pushing the real part further and forward, if this thing is going to behave like A1. Yeah, if it's not, so in other words, it behaves like its first non-zero term. So, therefore, you can always show that in some half plane, it's going to be non-vanishing. Now, of course, the hard question is, if I pin you down and say, which half plane? And that's a hard question even for zeta prime. Take the derivative of the Riemann zeta function. It doesn't vanish in some half plane. Which half plane? What is the abscissa? And I don't think that's known, right? So it's somewhere between 2 and 3. Is that the best that's known? Yeah. It's somewhere between 2 and 3. That's all that we know. But the fact that it's non-vanishing in some half plane is there. And so here we don't know. Are we at the edge of that? Are we inside? Where are we with respect to... But the point one sort of, which is so significant for the L function itself, now doesn't help you. You know, so the more natural object is this thing, because at least here you have some kind of geometric interpretation for it. Okay, I think that's the top there.